I'm reminded of my a comment made by my colleague Deborah Rohde that having a conference is sort of like having a boat. You don't want to have one, but you want to have a friend that has one. And so we're so lucky that we have friends like Adelaide and Anne and the others who've done all the hard work to organize the conference, and so we can just go boating for the day and enjoy all their hard work. And we're also glad to come and talk to you all as you're trying to raise the gender question. I would just sort of say, please learn from all of our mistakes as well as our limited success, but don't overstate the success that we've had as you find your own path to figure out how to capitalize on what's come before you. And now that I'm a Southerner from the great state of Louisiana, I hope that I'll speak slowly enough for our translators. I'm also really glad to be here because one of the chapters of my book was on the European Union, another was on the UK. My editor said we didn't even need to edit the EU chapter since no one was going to read it, because no one is interested in judges in the European Union at all. So, or presumably Americans interested in anything outside of our borders. So hopefully I can go quickly through some of these points. One of the advantages of going a little later in the program is all the clever and profound points to be made on the topic have already been made several times, so I'll try not to belabor them. So why did I write this book? And I just want to say, for all that you were wondering how it's doing, it's been really, really favorably reviewed. My mom gave it 5 stars on Goodreads, which is our Facebook for readers, so I expect the sales to really increase soon. I'm a political scientist, as one of the 2 social scientists as part of the panel. I'm very frustrated. Most of my colleagues in political science would rather I just get a law degree and go over to law school and leave them alone. But in the U.S., you may not know that many state court judges are elected, and in the state of Louisiana, they run in partisan elections. So those of us who are interested in campaigns and elections as political scientists really have no excuse for ignoring the judiciary, and they're clearly significant aspects of our politics and our policymaking. But I've also been really troubled by, as an advocate for women's rights, that the groups that are taking up this question of how to increase women's political power largely ignore women in the judiciary. And I think that's really an oversight. And the same has been true in the European Union. I think you had the one sort of study on women in the judiciary in 1999. And then people have been talking a lot about women in decision making, but oftentimes really leaving out the judicial branch of government entirely and not counting judges as we look at how we're doing in our progress. And I think the next point is that, as Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, these things do not come of themselves. It's not just going to happen naturally or inevitably that women are going to increase their representation in the judicial branch of government. And the other point, I think, is that whatever we did as a social movement to secure the first women appointments or even go from token to minority is not necessarily going to be the same strategy that's going to help us get from minority to parity. And so I think we need to really think about what our strategies are for the time period and have our arguments suit those strategies. So I'm going to argue, I actually don't believe that women are nicer than men. I often wonder if feminists who make that claim have actually spent much time in the women's movement. But that's just my personal view. But I'm going to argue that our best arguments are ones that don't rest on women's difference. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the evidence that women decide cases somehow differently from men. So this is a familiar graph now on day 2 that women lawyers increased, although, and you can see the time period in the United States. But if you look at presidential appointments of women to the bench, you'll find that that's not a steady increase, that there's enormous variability and enormous backtracking. And so, for example, the first case is when Ronald Reagan took office, even though he deflected criticism of his judicial appointments by appointing the first woman to the U.S. Supreme Court, he was appointing about half the level of President Carter, who was the first woman to really significantly appoint women to the bench. And the same thing happened when Bush came in after Clinton. And I found it remarkable. I had asked the White House counsel, Rachel Brand, you know, how does President Bush think about gender in judicial appointments? Because Laura Bush had really pushed for a woman on the Supreme Court, and President Bush wanted that as well and was vetoed by conservatives in his own party who made him withdraw the woman he had nominated to serve on the Supreme Court. And she said, oh, I think you'll find the numbers are the same as our predecessors. And so I sent her the spreadsheet, and I said, well, I see a 29 to 22% drop. Could you tell me the names that I'm leaving out? So the fact that someone could just assert that in a speech and say the numbers are the same means no one's watching, no one's counting, and nobody's following it. And so that's really the sort of the fact that you could really significantly go backwards and no one's paying any attention whatsoever. What's going on right now, I think I want to draw people's attention to, is that the opportunity we have because of President Obama's more diverse appointments. Now, if we look at the state level, we see a plateau of women state Supreme Court judges. And I would just say that even though there's been a lot of talk about the pyramid is not really a very good accurate representation of women if we look at the state court level, because oftentimes there'll be more women as a percentage of state Supreme Courts than women on lower courts. And in fact, the statistics show that there's no necessary relationship between them. So it's not just the case that if we get women at the bottom, they'll naturally trickle up, or that there's some sort of relationship between those two numbers. They tend to be quite separate, and the movement between courts and between state and federal courts is a complex one and not a natural progression in any sense. The other thing that's interesting is how much variation there is by state, and this is one of the things that I've been working on now. And basically, people have been talking a lot about culture and whether culture explains the percentages, the variation in the percentages of women, and I'm making a strong case against that. So for example, my political science colleagues will say things like women can't win in the South, because women are represented at very low levels. Louisiana's just moved into first place for having the lowest percentage of women in its state legislature, as well as the highest national rates of chlamydia, in case you wanted to know. Yet we're right in the middle of the pack for our representation of women on state courts. So if women can't win in the South, how come they can win election to judicial office? And I think that's something that needs to be explored, and that's one of the things I'm working on now. But there's a lot of variation among the states. So these numbers of 30% or 33% actually conceal the fact that some states have significantly less than that, and some states. So to what extent is there any kind of norm about women's representation? If you remember this graph, right, this plateau, the other thing that graph conceals is there's what I call reversals, which is not in the doctrinal sense of being overruled, but this is on state Supreme Courts, the number of women who served who've then been replaced by a man. So even though there's some steady progress, there's many examples where a woman who had the seat is her, when she retires or vacates the seat, is replaced by a man without much notice or commentary. And since Judith has nicely placed Iowa as the center of the universe, which is the state that I'm from, and I know a very popular destination from Europe, this is now the Iowa Supreme Court. And after the Iowa Supreme Court voted that gay marriage is required by the equality law of the Iowa State Constitution, all of the judges who were up for retention in the subsequent election were voted out of office, including the only women. And now that is an all-male bench, which has actually generated a really interesting campaign I'm going to talk about in a moment. So my conclusions are that women's progress in the judiciary does not flow inevitably or naturally from women's progress in the legal profession, and nor is there any relationship between lower and higher courts, so that if we just get women on the lower courts, then inevitably we'll have women on the higher courts, but you already know that here. And that the progress is reversible and easily reversible and without notice reversible. And so we can really question, what does it mean to even call it a norm if the norm is so readily violated without any sort of notice or sanction? So I'm here to talk about making the case for women on the bench. And what I would like to do is suggest that we take some information from the campaign to have more racial and gender diversity on juries in the United States. And particularly in the South, people could eventually see what was wrong with black defendants being tried by an all-white jury, that maybe that wasn't communicating a fair and impartial system and was a problem for the legitimacy of its decisions. And later then the racial bar was the sex bar to women serving on juries. And women campaigned, and it was one of the last legal sex-based classifications that was actually struck down as a violation of equal protection. And women who were arguing against the exclusion of women from juries, some of them said the harm of women's exclusion is because women are different from men. Therefore, when you exclude women, you do not have a fair trial, particularly for women defendants. Other women in the campaign said women are the same as men, so therefore, just because they're capable of rationality, just like men, and fairness, and dispassionate, non-emotional decision-making, so you can't exclude them as citizens, and so barring them from the juries is wrong. And the women didn't have to agree amongst themselves about the difference or the sameness argument to agree that they wanted women on juries. And I think we can make the same argument. We can, if necessary, agree to disagree about the difference question and still conclude that we want to have women on the bench. Ninka has already brought up the point about the International Criminal Court, it's not just having women, but having judges who may be women or may not be women who have experience of gender-based violence. And the same insights from the International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, that it's not enough to just say, please, let's have some gender balance, but if you don't have a quota, that gender balance can easily be reversed. And the other evidence that we're learning from studies that have done out of the Brennan Center at New York University is that you need to train selectors, if they're nominating commissions, on implicit bias. And those selection commissions need to actively recruit and see their role as recruiter, not just vetter, if they're going to have better results. So here's what I think are the best arguments, and I've made the point about juries already, but if you think about the argument about citizenship, before women had the vote, people used to say, well, women don't need the vote because they just vote like their husbands. And so their preferences are captured by their husbands' votes. And then women finally won the vote. And that may well be true. My husband just became a naturalized citizen. I presume we vote the same, although he's, you know, his own strange person, so you never know what's going on in there. But we don't make that argument anymore. We say an indispensable part of citizenship is that everyone votes, whether their vote is different from one another or not. And I think the same can be said for women serving on the bench. I also think we should really draw on thinking of courts as representative institutions, and that gender is not a deviation from thinking about courts as representative institutions. You are very familiar with the language balancing issues. Geographic representation is a part of almost all international courts. And even in the United States, on our Court of Appeals, there's a requirement that you have at least one judge from each state in the circuit. and no one is running regression analysis to try to disentangle whether the Mississippi judge speaks in a different voice from the Louisiana judge. And so if they don't speak in a different voice, we can then exclude them from the bench. We just say they have to be there. And why is it okay that there has to be a German judge on the European Court of Justice, but there doesn't have to be any women? It's just a very bizarre argument. This argument has been well rehearsed already, but if you draw on the example of juries and the general sort of premise in the judicial system that it's not enough that justice be done, but justice must be seen to be done, and if you don't have a diverse and representative bench, that's not the case. And I also recommend drawing on an argument by a British feminist theorist named Anne Phillips, who says surely in 2013, we should just shift the burden of proof and say, why shouldn't there be 50% of women judges? You have the burden of proof for advancing that argument, as opposed to we have the burden of proof for advancing the argument that women should be on the bench. And then my background in employment discrimination leads me to suggest that we think about judging as a job. And when you have a large disjuncture between the qualified labor pool and those selected, you sense that there's something intentionally or unintentionally operating with your selection mechanism that is unfairly winnowing people out that needs to be examined. And that's a very pretty much straightforward proposition in employment discrimination that somehow seems to be forgotten when we're talking about the judiciary as a job. And then the other point that people make, that when true merit is at work, that women do as well or better than the men. And we found when we talked to senators about how they made their recommendations to the president that it just so happened that the best man for the job was Walter Mondale in the case of Minnesota's brother-in-law and law partner. Or it just was the case that the person who is the best man for the job in Iowa for the Eighth Circuit happened to have been the college roommate of the congressman. So I think there's a lot of illusions about how much meritocracy is actually operating. So this is one of the things that I found extremely frustrating. We've seen similar pictures. If I keep losing estrogen as an alarming rate, I wonder if these pictures are actually going to do us justice. But you will notice that there is one woman on this bench, Diana Murphy, and let's see, she's right there. This is the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the seven states of the northern Midwest in the United States. It's the least gender and racially diverse of all the federal appellate courts. And there's only been one woman ever out of 61 judges who've served on that court. And even just getting this picture was really difficult because most people had no idea who's on the Eighth Circuit. So we started this project called the Infinity Project, which is so clever that nobody gets it, because the Eighth Circuit, the sign for infinity is eight. Judge Diana Murphy suggested we chose it because it was going to take until infinity to actually have a gender diverse bench. So we decided to campaign to get more women on the Eighth Circuit, and I'm happy to report that we've had one success, which is Jane Kelly of Iowa, who's just been confirmed for that bench. And perhaps more importantly, she's a public defender, which is also very unusual in our circuit courts. So after 7 years of effort, we finally had our first success on the Infinity Project. And this is some of the other things that the project has done to get that success. And one of the things that's really noteworthy for those of us who are following the federal gridlock is that the two senators from Iowa are from two different political parties, and they're unique in the country in that they have had an agreement amongst themselves that they wouldn't sabotage each other's judicial nominees. So Jane Kelly was actually supported by Senator Grassley, even though he's opposing all of President Obama's other appointments to the federal bench. because of his agreement with Senator Harkin that they wouldn't sabotage each other. So Iowa was this sort of quirky case where, and Jane Kelly may be one of the few women who sort of slips through. When we were being trained by people who were working on strategic messaging about how to talk about Justice Sotomayor's confirmation, these are the pieces of advice that they gave us. And the one point I would notice is that as a general principle, we might advocate for women on the bench, but that's not a message that resonates more largely. And so we were advised to talk about people's qualifications and not to make the gender case explicitly if we wanted to be successful. So that brings me to the latest controversy. I happen to have the thrill of being invited to the White House Rose Garden when President Obama named these three people to the DC Circuit Court of Appeals. And this is a really important court because it's the federal appeals court, but it's the court from which a very high percentage of judges are chosen to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. So basically, if you don't have women and minority men in this pipeline, it's very hard to get them on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I bring up this example because there was a White House forum on judicial selection, and following from Judith's paper yesterday, I was really alarmed at who wasn't at that event and who wasn't campaigning. And for example, the National Association of Women Judges wasn't there. Most of the women's groups weren't there. And my view is, if women judges aren't going to advocate for themselves, who is? And that was one of the impetus for founding the National Association of Women Judges, but they have kind of lost their focus and their presence on this issue. But also, the only real group that's working on this issue effectively is the National Council for Jewish Women, who and Planned Parenthood, who are working on this issue. So the larger women's community is really absent from this movement to change the gender composition of courts, which includes getting these people confirmed. And at the moment, they're being filibustered in the Senate. And there's a coalition of groups called Courts Matter, which is a coalition of progressives who are trying to educate non-legal people who care about progressive politics why the composition of the courts matter, to create a broad coalition to get Obama's diverse and representative nominees confirmed. And so this is just one example of the ad they're using in Texas for the two women on the DC circuit. There's a lot of fun stuff going around. And this is a tweet that went out about the DC circuit yesterday. So I think I wish that legal groups, the Bar Association, women judges, and women's groups would really join this cause. I think we have a historic opportunity to have a more diverse and representative bench, but I just want to echo my colleagues who basically said, unless we mobilize and build a large constituency, it's not going to magically happen. And my focus has been basically all of the reversals so that we can have some success, particularly at the state level, and go backwards without any notice or comment. So I'll leave you with this latest portrait of our four women Supreme Court justices. Thank you.